Good morning. My name is Christy Fuggio. I'm from Physicians for Human Rights. I'm an immigration attorney by training, but I'm currently the director of the Asylum Program at Physicians for Human Rights. The Asylum Program includes a network of over 400 dedicated health professionals that provide forensic medical evaluations to immigrants who are seeking asylum in this country. In addition to doing the forensic medical exams, we also do advocacy around increasing uses of alternatives to detention and improving the access to quality medical service in immigration detention. So I'd like to start today by giving you a very brief outline of the immigration detention system and the population that's included there, and talk briefly about why we want to engage health professionals in our advocacy efforts. Next, I'll talk about some of the obstacles that we faced and some of the things that we have, some of the different advocacy efforts that we have health professionals involved in right now. Then I'll move into talking about the best practices, the lessons that we've learned as we've been engaging health professionals in these activities, and also what some of the substantive results that we've achieved in the past 10 months. So first, just to give you some of the numbers about the immigration detention system. You know, of course, people do entire presentations on this, so I want to go briefly just to give you an idea of the scale of the system. It's approximately 250 facilities across the country, and these are all different kinds of different facilities. Some are government-owned and operated, others are private contract facilities run by characters you know, like CCA or GEO. There are a number of detainees that are held in private jails, county jails, local jails. Basically, the government rents bed space for them, so they're being held alongside other criminals a good deal of the time. The system affects over 400,000 people each year. Some, not 400,000 at one time, of course. Some people are held just for a day. Others may be held several months or sometimes even years as they're waiting for their cases to move through the system. Unfortunately, we have a congressional mandate that there will always be at least 33,400 beds available every night to house immigration detainees. So, you know, we can be certain that around this number is being held every night in some immigration detention facility. The average number of days in detention is about 30. It varies greatly depending on where someone was picked up geographically in this country, what their country of origin is, what the state of their case is. The cost is huge, as you can see here, and the repercussions also. 113 people have died since 2003. And the reason we look at statistics back to 2003 is because this is the time when the old INS, you know, changed over to Department of Homeland Security and the system was restructured. This is what we call a detain for deportation model. So there's the idea is just to keep people healthy long enough so that we can deport them effectively. There's no mandate to maintain or restore health because there is the expectation that they won't be around in the system too long, and once serious health problems develop, probably they would be out of the system. So the system focuses on acute care. There's a serious lack of attention to chronic conditions such as asthma, hypertension, diabetes, tuberculosis, mental health, various mental health issues as well. The system is also marked with strong security concerns. There's overuse of shackles and solitary confinement, things like this that are meant to control the population. And there's a lack of transparency and accountability. Health professionals' roles are often ambiguous. It's not clear if they're trying to take care of the prisoners or if they're trying to work with security. There are multiple chains of command in the system. There are security personnel. Doctors have a chain of command. Nurses have a chain of command. There's often a lack of communication across these. So when troubles arise, when someone dies, when someone gets seriously ill, there's a lack of accountability and not enough attention to what they're going to do to prevent future deaths. And I can draw your attention to this quote that's on the Division of Immigration Health Services website. DIHS is a sub-agency of Department of Homeland Security, and they're ostensibly responsible for providing health care to all the immigration detainees. But as you can see, they provide the health services in support of immigration law enforcement. So we see a real concern with whether or not their main focus is providing health care or, in fact, supporting immigration law enforcement. Like the general prison population, this is a vulnerable population with advanced medical needs, chronic conditions, mental disabilities. But in addition, a great deal of these people are survivors of human rights abuses. Many have survived torture, other kinds of physical or psychological trauma. they have the advanced medical needs they have are related, often related to that kind of trauma, as well as troubles they may have that have occurred on the journey over to the United States. They may have gone many years without access to regular health care. And so the problem that we have as a result of all these things as well is that the intake screenings that are happening in detention centers are often too cursory. They're meant to happen on the day that someone arrives in immigration detention, but that often doesn't happen. Or it may be just a few questions, often given not even by health professionals. So this one great opportunity that there is to screen out people into alternatives to detention if they're really too ill to be held in detention, or at least to develop a program for restorative health for them, is lost because the intake screenings are not adequate. So I think the reasons why we want to engage health professionals as advocates are fairly obvious, but just to go over them briefly, of course the health professionals speak from direct experience. We engage people who have worked in immigration detention or at least work with people who have been released from immigration detention on the outside. Smart policymakers recognize the value of including the recommendations and suggestions of the health professionals. In addition to advocacy to policymakers, of course, we're always trying to raise public awareness about these issues, and the public respect for health professionals is considerable. Arguments that are advanced by health professionals are found to be much more credible and are much more likely to sway public opinion often than arguments advanced by attorneys or other kinds of advocates. And also, we find that a lot of the doctors that we work with, and doctors in general, are thought leaders, and they're already private advocates of health and human rights in their clinical work. Many of them do it on a micro level, so taking them onto the greater advocacy stage in DC on a bigger scale is not such a leap as it might appear. Of course, there are some obstacles to engaging health professionals. Busy schedules. Of course, most of the people that we work with already have full-time jobs, so the work that they do with us is on a voluntary basis, after office hours. Many, although they have clinical expertise, they may have some self-doubt about that, whether that's applicable to advocacy work. They may have doubt about their ability to communicate the problems. They may feel that they're not good writers or good public speakers, kind of wonder if there's better people out there to deliver these compelling messages to policymakers. There's also, a lot of confusion, I think, about the advocacy process and about the effectiveness of the advocacy process. And finally, of course, there are potential political concerns. The agenda that we work for at Physicians for Human Rights is very liberal, but not all of the doctors and the advocates that we work with are necessarily as liberal, so we have to be sensitive to that and understand that they may not be completely on board with what we're doing, and try and be sensitive to when they would be comfortable engaging in certain things and when they would not be. Right now we have health professionals engaged in a number of really great advocacy activities, and it really depends on their bandwidth, their availability, their interest. But the first thing that we have is we have three health professionals that are engaged in ongoing discussions with a medical working group. So Department of Homeland Security invited us and a bunch of other NGOs to get together to form this medical working group to have ongoing discussions about how to improve the screening process, how to making recommendations about who should be screened off out of detention to get into one of these community safeguards programs. This is a very deep advocacy opportunity. The doctors that are involved in this have to go to DC. They meet with people, they have ongoing meetings, so it's not the kind of activity that all of our health professionals can be involved in, because there has to be flexibility and time and interest to do that. But for those health professionals that are interested in getting involved in advocacy, but maybe don't have that much flexibility, there are a number of other things that they can do. And I've put some of these up there. Of course, responding to draft statements and recommendations, these are things that they can do from their office, online, via email. We talk on the phone with them. We send them different, things that other NGOs are considering putting out or things that DHS is considering implementing. They'll give us their feedback, and then we can pass that back along to the policymakers. They're also joining NGO coalitions with established congressional advisory roles. So some NGOs have already been asked by DHS or other policymakers, Department of Justice, to give them specific advice on you know, specific issues. Right now, we don't have an official role that way, but we get our health professionals connected with other NGOs who have those roles, so they have a great chance to impact the advisory relationships that way. And then there are a number of other things you can see here. And it really depends on the health professionals' interests and availability, but they can be involved in DC or from their offices or from their own homes, however much they're available to do. Next, to talk about some best practices, I should mention that we've only been really deeply involved in engaging health professionals since January of this year. That was when we got funding to have a dedicated person to engage health professionals in this kind of advocacy. So we've learned that, you know, the NGO role, our role is to be liaison, educator, and mobilizer, and that's throughout the whole process. So this is not a matter of simply identifying a health professional, giving them some brief background and saying, hey, go at it. We need to continually check in with them to introduce them to new people, to educate them about the process, to educate them about, you know, what our agenda is, what we're thinking of doing, to continue to mobilize them and keep them energized in what they're doing. Timing, of course, with any advocacy efforts is key. You want to look for your policy window for when you want to start the project and also for when you want to call on health professionals to get involved. From our perspective, the deaths in immigration detention were receiving a great deal of attention, particularly from 2007 to 2008. In addition, with the Obama administration coming in and DHS realizing that there was, you know, rising awareness and public criticism of the number of deaths, we realized it was a really good time to really force them to take on real meaningful immigration detention reform. In addition to timing and strategic thinking, how you want to mobilize the health professionals, you want to make your requests of them modest and tailored to their availability and their interests. So we don't want to keep banging out requests to the health professionals every day. Please call this congressperson. Please go to this meeting. Please comment on these recommendations. We want to make our requests strategic of them so that they know that when we're asking for their help, we're asking when it really counts. We're not just kind of, you know, hammering away too much. And we want to make the requests modest and to facilitate their participation in advocacy. So that can mean lots of different things. If we're asking them to call their congressperson, for example, you know, give them the telephone numbers. If we're asking them to write a letter to a congressperson or a policymaker, we give them a template and give them an opportunity to, you know, make revisions to that, or they can just sign off on it. If we're asking them to co-author a blog post or a letter to the editor, a journal article, again, we can write a first draft for them if, you know, if they're not, they don't have the time to do it themselves, and then they can just give their feedback and revise and edit and sign on as they're able to. Next, we want to be sure to identify and engage health professionals that we know already have an existing interest and or expertise in the subject matter. So right now we're drawing primarily from our asylum network that I mentioned before of over 400 health professionals. So of course, right now, off the top of my head, I can't tell you their names, all of their interests, all of their expertise, but we do know, you know, we can identify many of them, and we're working every day reviewing our database files, checking with people so that we can make sure that we have in mind who would be interested in this new topic that's coming up, who would have the great clinical experience to bring recommendations to this particular topic. And it's an ongoing process to make sure. But of course, we know that if we're identifying and engaging with health professionals who, for example, feel very strongly about solitary confinement, and they've dealt with people, they've seen the psychological trauma, of course, those are the people that we want to engage when we're giving recommendations to DHS to, you know, stop using solitary confinement. Listening to their recommendations and incorporating as appropriate, it sounds very obvious, but it can be tricky because, you know, especially when you're getting feedback or recommendations from many health professionals, they're not all necessarily going to go together. They're not all going to be in alignment. They may not all be in alignment with what your program's position is. So, you know, of course you want to try and incorporate as much as possible, but keep communication open so that they understand if you're not going down this path, if you're not comfortable including some of the recommendations, that they understand why. So I think communication is the key here. And finally, the last one, it sounds a little bit shallow, but I think it's very important, especially with young health professionals, people who are trying to build their careers and build their own experience, to highlight opportunities to them where they can build their resume, an opportunity to be a panelist, an advisor, to co-author a medical journal article, something like that, are very appealing to a lot of health professionals, as I mentioned, particularly young ones who want to build their resumes. So we have a number of positive results over the past 10 months I'd like to share with you. We've had 80 health professionals engaged in some sort of advocacy over the past 10 months, and that can be anything from just co-signing on to a letter that we're sending to Department of Homeland Security, co-authoring a blog, or it can be, you know, as I mentioned, being part of that working medical group that's going to DC and working working on a regular basis with Department of Homeland Security. We're seeing a progression of activities from group activities to solo activities. And a group activity is something that we classify as just being one more person to sign on to a letter. And a solo activity is actually going to a meeting at Department of Homeland Security. So we're seeing a lot of the health professionals that started off being only comfortable with doing group activities to being more and more willing to reach out, spend more time, and stretch themselves to do more solo activities. And that's something that we're hoping to continue to see. We're also feeling a growing recognition of the expertise of the health professionals that are working in our network and our expertise in the field of immigration detention reform. So we're getting more phone calls from our NGO colleagues. We're getting more requests from Department of Homeland Security. A few months ago, Department of Homeland Security asked us to facilitate a roundtable about the various mental health issues that are faced by immigration detainees. So that was a really great opportunity for us to be able to frame the issues, to identify health professionals who would have great experience, and to bring them in as panelists. For substantive results that we've seen, very briefly, we're going to see, right now there's not electronic medical records in the immigration detention system. It's a problem because people are often transferred very quickly in the middle of the night. They're transferred multiple times. And when their medical records don't go with them, of course, so much knowledge is lost. So DHS has recently committed to implementing electronic records into the system. It will be a many years implementation process due to the nature of the system, as I mentioned, the 250 facilities across the country. But they have committed to doing it, and in January they're going to put out a request for proposals for systems to for companies to undertake the implementation of that system. So that's a huge win we're very happy with. Next is an overhaul of the TARS system. TARS is the Treatment Authorization Request System. And the way that operates currently is that when a doctor in a detention system recommends that someone have, for example, an MRI at an outside facility, there has to be approval from that from a higher source. The doctor alone cannot give, the doctor can make the recommendation, but a nurse outside the facility is the one who can give the approval, yes or no. With the new system, it's going to be called a payment authorization system. And so rather than having the power to override the doctor's recommendation, the person outside approving or denying the care or the recommendation is only going to be looking at whether the person is eligible, i.e. whether or not that person is indeed in immigration detention. So there will no longer be the power outside to override the doctor's recommendation for additional care. And finally, we're seeing a growing awareness of mental health issues of people in immigration detention. As I mentioned before, we saw that when DHS asked us to host the roundtable, and we're seeing more and more NGOs and policymakers talking about this issue and realizing that something needs to be done. So we've just gotten the word a couple weeks ago that we got funding to continue this program for another 2 years. So we're very excited to be able to continue to engage more and more health professionals in this advocacy and to go beyond and take on more and more issues. Thank you.